Welcome to the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran, and my co-host, as always, is Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. Good to have you in the studio.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Maeve.
A great local read is what we've all been enjoying in August, and it will resonate with so many of our listeners because local areas get a shout out. The foothills of Boulder County really are featured in this book. In many ways, it's an ode to the mountain living, an ode to a wonderful pet, a dog, and just a wonderful memoir. Tell us about Rough Beauty.
Rough Beauty is by Karen Ovenin, and she put together this memoir, and it really starts with a very dramatic scene, the burning down of her cabin up near Jamestown. But she takes us back through her life. And I think it's beautifully told. I think there's people who love nature, people who are very interested in, as you said, the mountains, the foothills of Boulder, and also people who love dogs are going to love this book. And I think she did a great job pulling all these pieces together in a very moving memoir.
Well, we're delighted to have Karen Ovenin in the studio. Thanks for coming in.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm really excited.
Thanks for coming down the mountain as well. Yeah. And as we said, this is a love story to living in the mountains, but also to your dog. And I want to get a shout out right away to Elvis, who was your companion for, what, 15 years?
Yeah, 15 years almost. He died at 15 and a half, and despite every single thing that was wrong with him, you know, physically, he lived to be very old. And like I say in the book, I think he lived until the day he died. So it wasn't, there was no long decline. It was fantastic. And then it was time and then he went.
Well, so we'll hear more about Elvis as the interview progresses. But as Arsene says, the scene, it really starts with a very dramatic scene, and it's your cabin burning down. Now, not because of a wildfire, as people who are listening might think, oh, she was caught up in one of the many local wildfires we've had, but it was just your particular cabin actually caught on fire.
Yeah, my cabin, so it was a wood stove fire, so some malfunction in the wood stove. I lived in a cabin that was heated completely by a wood stove, and I was out delivering mail, which was one of my part-time jobs. I'm a writer. I have many jobs, and my dog was with me, and I came back, and there was this kind of voluminous orange cloth in the, you know, the woods, and it was my house. So and I lost everything. I had just finished my PhD, most of my writing, all of my books, everything I ever owned, but I had Elvis, so that was the most important thing.
And you really came to realize that. I mean, it was a hard journey to get over the grief of such a traumatic and drastic loss of everything.
Well, you know, I kept imagining Sisyphus because I was just about to turn 40 and I had just finally arrived and I was going to be a writer and live in this cabin and I was all set. And it was the first time I really lived alone and it was a place I wanted to live. And then it just all disappeared in a morning, essentially. And I kind of thought, I don't really know how I don't know how I start again. And I have to say that one of the things that really helped me was the town of Jamestown. There's no way I would have been able to recover except for them. I mean, you know, and people say, and I didn't really particularly like the town. And so I was stunned and also really humbled by the experience. If this had happened in Boulder, I don't think I would have experienced the generosity that I experienced from Jamestown. So.
Yeah, the fire really deepened your relationship to that place in a way that you needed probably to move to the next step, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely, because I had kind of built what I call my cowgirl ethos. I was just going to do it all by myself, and I didn't need anybody. And that's kind of why I cover my childhood in the book, is because I started to think about, well, why did I move to the mountains? Why did I have to be alone? But Jamestown comes to the rescue, and you know, they really taught me the real meaning of community, which is, you know, community isn't a group of people who are like-minded. It's a bunch of people who kind of like, a real community is a place where you hate people and you argue with them and you don't talk to them or whatever, but when somebody needs help, everybody drops that stuff because we realize essentially it's petty and you pitch in. And that's what happened for me in Jamestown, and it softened my heart a little bit, I gotta say.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. You talk about the background. You kind of grew up with an Air Force brat. So, you know, your dad was in the Air Force and you had to go around. And you really didn't grow up with a sense of community. It didn't seem at all. And then, you know, you had patches where you had some, at one point in Colorado, things were going well for you in school. And then you got yanked out of school and had to move, right? And things weren't so good. But you didn't have that community, and your family wasn't even providing that community, in the sense that your father was very charismatic but abusive. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to me, the interesting arc of the book is that when you're living that life, you're reacting to not having community by toughing it out by yourself, as you said. And it seems to me that if that fire had never happened, you might never have had the more healthy reaction, in a way, to going towards community rather than away from community to your childhood. And so it's very interesting in that sense.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I think, you know, of course it's, you know, the first thing I thought was, okay, this was meant to be. And then, you know, which gave me a certain amount of liberation. And then, you know, then the grief followed after that and the shock, I think. But I do think that it was a catalyst that really changed my life. And it made me really decide, okay, what do you want? And who do you want to be? And who do you want to be with? And I was really touched by the generosity of Jamestown, and as a result, started to kind of tentatively get involved and then get really involved. There's a really great arts community in Jamestown, and I got onto the board of their arts organization and started, you know, kind of making trouble of my own, which was fantastic. And I think it was a very important thing that happened. And I think I was managed to kind of make something good come out of it.
So. Yeah. I mean, that's what you get reading the book. The thing that's interesting is this individual ethos you had. I mean, you had good friends in graduate school, and you talk about them, mm-hmm. and your teachers, but you know, extended even to relationships, you know, like romantic relationships. Like, you would put that to the side, or you weren't really, during that time period, it seemed, pursuing that kind of thing in your life. Like, you really wanted to focus or whatever. It seemed like you kind of walled some of these parts of yourself off. To me, it seemed like, in reaction to that childhood.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's a way that my personality is kind of built in reaction to. I mean, my dad is a very strong figure, and I wasn't going to go the way he wanted me to go, which was to be somebody's wife. Like, I was told I would be, I mean, I'm not, okay, I was a child of the 60s and the 70s, you know, I'm not that old necessarily. But I just thought, no, I don't want that. And then when my friends in high school, the only thing that they wanted was to fall in love, I thought, gosh, that's so frivolous. And so I was a second generation feminist longing for role models. And I just thought, well, I'll just, and you know, I live in the West. So I thought, oh, well, I'll be the Marlboro Man. I'll just do it all by myself. And I thought, I'll show them that I can do it all by myself. And so, yes, I sidestepped the idea of relationship for most of my life. And I have to say, honestly, though, the one presence in my life that actually got me closer to relationship was actually initially Elvis. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, I wanted to say that you did have a massive love affair, but it was with the dog.
With a dog. And I mean, it makes me sound like a crazy dog love lady, but that dog, I would not be where I am emotionally today without him. I got to, and I think for the first time I experienced what really unconditional love is like. And, you know, I should have gotten that as a kid and in my family, but I didn't. And I suddenly, you know, realized there were days that I couldn't stand the dog and days that I adored the dog. And but the greatest thing about an animal, which unfortunately does not happen with human beings, is that the animal is always happy to see you. No matter what, if you've yelled at them in the morning and you go away and you come home, they're so happy that you're back. And that is the greatest gift ever, I think, because you realize, okay, I'm taking myself too seriously.
No, you write beautifully about your relationship with Elvis, yeah. But particularly when Elvis dies, and he survived a lot of illnesses and really outlived the predictions, I suppose, that the vets had given him. You know, they might just give him a few weeks, but he's trucking along the following season. But you did a beautiful ceremony, I suppose, when ultimately that you made that decision that to end his suffering.
I really feel like that's actually one of my proudest moments. It's probably my proudest moment in my relationship with that dog. And one of my proudest moments in my life is that I felt like I gave him a good death. And I wish that in our culture, we faced death with a much more clear and compassionate eye. I mean, the idea of putting my dog to down and then letting his body go somewhere to be cremated just wasn't the answer to what kind of relationship that we had. And so, I mean, I went with him the whole way. I brought him down to the crematorium. I put his body into the oven myself. I was there when he came out and he was bones. And for me, that really was a completion. I mean, yes, there was a ceremony and people sang and there were bells ringing and all kinds of stuff. But for me, I feel like this kind of stewardship of death is something that we're missing in our culture. And it really completed our relationship and in a way that was really satisfying for me.
And it seemed to really help in your grieving process as well.
Yes, I needed to go all the way through the end with him. My mother passed in a few years. I mentioned it in the book, but she passed a few years after Elvis. And I remember that she died and I went and said goodbye. And then that was it. And the next thing I was, picking up her ashes at a funeral home. And that it was just so strange mm-hmm. to me.
Well, I thought the juxtaposition of your mother's decline and Elvis's decline was very interesting in that, Elvis's decline was something that you were really primarily dealing with. But, and this happens with people too, and I think this complicates people's deaths, is that you had competing interests. You had your siblings, what they wanted, what they were willing to do. There was much more politics sort of involved with, you couldn't just make decisions on your own for your mother in anywhere near the same way. And your mother herself has a will, her own free will of what she might want to do. And so I thought that was interesting in the book that those two things are happening at the same time, and one is very moving, but you have some level of control or some ability to make things happen in a way that's meaningful, and the other one, which is your mother, you don't quite have that same ability.
No, and I didn't have the same kind of relationship with her. I mean, we did at the very end, finally. Of course, I'm the oldest daughter. We had she expected a lot of me and gave very little in return. And I resented for a long, long time having to take care of her. But I have a really, despite everything, I have a very strong sense of duty. And so I thought, this is what you do. And so it was much more difficult, but it was also a nightmare. There were nights when I think, who's going to go first, my mother or the dog, my mother or the dog? And it was really, it was pretty stressful, but I had moments of grace with my mother as well at the end when I just finally stopped fighting. I tried so hard to give her a good life in her decline, and she really was so, she was in hospice for 2 years. She was in a bed for 2 years. She never left it. And she was moderately demented. So she didn't really understand where she was. And she was happy. And I thought, she's happy. I'm going to accept that she's happy. And then she started to be really loving with me in a way she was never loving in my life. And that was an immense, immense gift.
One of the major pieces of healing for you is the landscape and your relation to the landscape and living up in the mountains. And you have a beautiful passage I was hoping you could read for us, and the listeners can hear the writing in the book, which I think is quite lovely, and also this aspect of how the landscape works on you to help heal you.
Sure, I'd love to. This is Elvis and I encounter a coyote on the solstice in this passage. On the solstice, Elvis and I encountered a curious coyote who stepped absentmindedly between two junipers toward us as I sat in the late afternoon of the longest day near an overlook just past the Peeper Pond. I had discovered a roughened stone spiral in a grouping of rocks and gathered more to fill in its gaps, my own personal semaphore, to welcome summer, whose official arrival, I mused, marked the now dwindling days. The spiral contained the mystery of that contradiction, a beginning that presaged an end, the ever-changing flux of seasons. But it also recalled my hard and soft edges, the unraveling I had begun to feel. Not the unraveling of the fire, the way I'd been shorn of everything but grief, but the unraveling of fists held too tight for too long, of borders becoming porous, my body slackened, opening to pleasure. I was staring at the spiral's arm radiating out and radiating in when the coyote came into view. The animal's mottled gray russet and russet fur blew in scruffy patches along her neck. Long legs dangled loosely from her body. Her eyes were gold. Gently, I put my hand out to hold my dog's harness. Elvis's ears moved forward, and his tail made a friendly swish in the dirt, but he didn't so much as growl. "It's okay," I breathed. Even he sensed the extraordinary nature of what was happening. 15 feet away, the coyote took 4 automatic steps toward us before she saw us. Clearly, she'd come this way before. As fluidly as she appeared, she disappeared, turning with neither alarm nor hubbub, angling back over the small rise. Just another animal in the landscape.
We're speaking with author Karen Ovenan in the Radio Book Club today, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran. My co-host, as always, Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. The book we're talking about is Rough Beauty, 40 Seasons of Mountain Living, those mountains being just west of Boulder in the foothills. And we talked a lot about, you know, the mentality, I suppose, of living in the mountains. And a lot of it is, I think, people who live in the mountains don't want to live in the town, because if they did, they'd be in the town, right? But you have that sense of community as well. But I know you were very conscious of writing about real communities like Jamestown and respecting people's privacy, because it's a memoir. So, of course, it's your story, but your story intersects with so many other stories, that of your family and that of the people you meet. What were some of the ways that you navigated that, being loyal to your own story, but also respecting maybe people's privacy who may not want to be included or be featured in a book?
Well, happily for me, I think the people that may not wanted to be have been featured probably won't read the book. If I mean, and those people are not major characters, they might be minor characters. I think, he's never going to read this book, so yes, I will use his name. But I did change names. I shifted things around there. So I try to be respectful of other people's feelings, but one of the ways you do that, I think, as a writer, is you try to be really clear. This is me telling this story. And if you ask anybody else in Jamestown, if you go into the Merck on a Saturday night and you say, "What happened at poetry night?" you're going to get 25 different versions. So I try to be really clear. And I also try to make myself as silly and as goofy and as strange as the rest of Jamestown. I started in Jamestown kind of looking down my nose at the antics of the locals. And then I just realized quite suddenly, oh, I'm a local too. And so I think I include myself, and I try to be really honest about my foibles as well. So far, I have had no angry messages from Jamestown.
Well, I think you write very fondly about the community, and you mentioned the antics at the market. I mean, you worked there for a certain time. And
yeah, many, many years, actually, on and off. And yes, I am very fond. I mean, my friends would talk about this. They said, "You have to write about Jamestown," because I had a really love-hate relationship. And it was great because I live 4 miles above the town. And when I was just sick of the town, and this is true of many people in Jamestown, you just kind of pass on through, or you don't go to the Merck for a while. You kind of have these moments where you're in love with the town and these moments where you kind of hate the town. And it is a small town. But, you know, that also really helped me figure out, oh, what does it mean to be in relationship with people? What do you let go? How do you kind of cohabitate and coexist? And also learn to respect people with whom you disagree or who you may not like. And so it was very important to me.
Well, you brought some of your goofiness, as you said, or whatever, to Jamestown that you have been cultivating, it seems. Like, you had your own holidays. You kind of did an anti-Valentine's Day thing. You did a F.T.S. Eliot holiday.
Right.
Well, can you tell us about the F.T.S. Eliot and how that started?
So this started when I was in grad school, actually, at the University of Colorado. And I decided that, you know, in grad school, I was just really, you know, my opposition personality. I was so sick of earnest young male grad students telling me how wonderful T.S. Eliot was. And I just was like, why aren't you talking about Sylvia Plath? Why aren't you talking about somebody else? And so, and February, of course, especially in Colorado, I think is kind of like the worst time of the year. It's when everybody goes to Mexico, which is something I've yet to do. And I thought, well, let's celebrate and let's lighten the dark days of February, and, you know, kind of in this over the top way. So I decided that we would FTS Eliot, and who said April is the cruelest month? And I decided it was February. I was like, you're wrong. And so I threw this, and, you know, really honestly, it was, I get my student loan check, and then I would spend a chunk of it making this dinner for my grad student friends. And, you know, in the first year, like, you know, like, so the writer Jim Campbell, he brought pheasants that he'd shot in Wisconsin, and the writer David Gessner and Nina de Grammont were there, and we were all in grad school. We weren't, you know, like writers yet. David was in charge of Bombast, so if you know David, he's a big talker, and we used to say in grad school, tonight we drink, for tomorrow we write. And part of one of my jobs is that I'm a cook. I've been a professional cook. I've made wedding cakes. I've catered, and it's something that I did all through school. So, and I have a deep interest in cooking. And at that time, I was working at the Peppercorn, and I was their book buyer. And so I would just, you know, kind of talk to chefs and put this menu together. And it's continued. And I don't know how many years it's been, but I still have the T.S. Eliot party every February. And there's a theme every year. And sometimes it's been a murder mystery. And the food is always, mostly always over the top. So, mm-hmm. So, and I don't know. I was writing an application recently. Then they said, and it's an application for something huge. And they said, tell us about what you're known for. And I said, honestly, I'm known for my dinner parties. You know, like my ability to kind of put interesting people together, have really good food, and people have a lot. You know, they're usually legendary.
Well, there's a lot of food in the book, yeah. And I love. You know, you're making dinner for somebody, and I think it's pizzas, and you're putting on gorgonzola cheese on the pizza or whatever, and at the end, I think whoever you're hosting says, like, well, that was pretty fancy, or you know, there's some acknowledgement, like, and for you, though, you're just kind of whipping it up. This is like a natural thing for you to do.
That was Greg. When I first met him, so this is my partner, when I first met him, you know, I, like, he's a very much a kind of meat and potatoes. He gets nervous about if he thinks a restaurant is too fancy. And I've, you know, kind of worn him down over the years, but I made, you know, like a gorgonzola pizza with, I can't remember what I put on it, figs or something. And you know, of course, in the blush of new love, he says, this is fantastic. And then later he said, that was really fancy. And for me, it is kind of every day. People are afraid to cook for me, but there's nothing better than having someone serve something to you. I think that's the best thing ever.
Well, going back to the very beginning of the book, which is when you lost everything, when your cabin went on fire. I mean, one of the things that you lost were these beautiful serving plates, and you had a lovely table. I mean, that ties into the food theme. You like to entertain, and it's not just about what people are eating, it's the whole ritual and the whole, you know, there are so many other elements, not just the consumption of food.
No, I like beauty. I just moved to the mountains, and we 2 months ago just had a housewarming this last weekend, and people said, it's like you've lived here for a year. And I thought, you don't know who I am, do you? I'm a tourist. Comfort and beauty are very important to me. So yeah, it's the whole ritual. And also the idea of beauty is really why I kind of moved to the mountains in the first place.
We're speaking with author Karen Ovenen today on the KGNU Boulder Bookstore Radio Book Club about her new book, Rough Beauty, 40 Seasons of Mountain Living. And many of the years that you were there, you were in Jamestown, as we've talked about. And for people who aren't familiar with Jamestown, it has a reputation, I suppose, of being a quirky town west of Boulder in the foothills.
But not as quirky as Ward.
We'll keep Ward on. Weird.
Kind of
that was always
quirky.
The thing. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, we can get into that in a minute. But it also, since 2013, has really cultivated the idea, which the people who'd lived there obviously knew, of community, because in 2013, of course, there was the flood. And you talk about this at the end of the book. And throughout the entire book, when I was reading it, I was wondering, gosh, was Karen in the flood and what happened? Because I knew how Jamestown had been impacted by the flood. I had the mark and the previous owner, Joey, of course, was tragically killed by the mudslide downtown.
It actually
Jamestown.
Came from the top of Porphyry. So his house was on the west side of town, and so here is nature at work. The Jamestown had a fire, a historic fire, 9 months before my cabin burned down, and it scoured the top of Porphyry and about, you know, 13 structures on top, and these were off-the-grid structures. People lived in them. And but then what often follows fire is flood, because now there's nothing to keep the water from kind of like rushing down. And that's what happened to Joey. You know, this kind of slurry of mud and lumber slammed into the back of his house and kind of moved it 4 feet off its foundation. So, but that the other thing is that that incident probably saved the town from much worse, because his roommate was in the front room and climbed out, went across the street to Nancy Farmer's house and said, "You have to get out now." And because now the access down canyon, so to Boulder, was blocked by this big mudslide. And they started to wake people up. It's midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, and people didn't know what had happened. And he went up to Rainbow and Adam's house. They're the people who own the Merck now. If they might not have gotten out at all, if they had, somebody had not gone up and said, "Get out now." They kind of, there's a story about them kind of going over a log with their Subaru and stuff like that. So it was terrifying. I think the flood, Jamestown coalesced around, after the fire, around each other helping, and they have always come together. You know, somebody doesn't have insurance and people hold a benefit. But I think, and the flood has had some other kinds of interesting impacts in terms of, you know, how do you rebuild a town? A third of the houses were gone after the flood. And there's still, if you drive up to Jamestown, a carcass of a house at on the confluence of James Creek and the Little James that is still waiting to be rebuilt. So.
And of course, there had to be a massive airlift because the roads had been destroyed and you were all essentially cut off. You were airlifted out.
I was not airlifted. I lived 4 miles above Jamestown. So I came, but I had, at the top of Overland Mountain, I had 4 inches of standing water, which is a little scary on top of a mountain. And then I walked down and I saw that I couldn't get into the town because the road was washed out. And that was when they were finishing the airlift. And a guy came to me and said, "If you're leaving, you need to leave now. We're not going to come back." And in fact, some people stayed in town, and I have some friends who kind of basically rationed their food and stayed in town. So the water's out, and they can't really get in or out, and they stayed. They got really skinny. And then another friend, she decided to stay and take care of the pets that couldn't be airlifted out. So it was kind of amazing. So
we're just a few weeks shy of the 5th anniversary of that. And so have the people that you certainly write about in the book, you know, what's their status? Because I know some people lost their homes and many of the characters that feature in the book, you know, how's Jamestown doing now 5 years later?
I think it's still healing. I really do. This was a huge schism for the town. I mean, there's now the town is kind of divided into people who want to rebuild the way it was, which is impossible, and people who want to move forward. And so there's been a lot of and, you know, of course, Jamestown got an incredible amount of federal funding to help it. And it looks different. You know, now there's all the bridges that go across the creek have to be withstand a 100-year flood. I think it might even be a 1,000-year flood. I'm not sure. But so I think this is something that's going to take a long time to fade for people. And, you know, I can speak to this after my fire. For years, I had nightmares about fires. You know, if there was, you know, I remember when the 4 Mile Canyon fire happened and I was standing there like I could walk 2 ridges over and see the flames, and I would have nightmares about fire. So I'm sure that it's going to take a while for it to recede.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it could take a generation. Yeah. I mean, when I think about it in terms of your book, it took you 30 years to kind of get over your childhood to some extent.
Yeah.
And some people never get over their childhoods and trauma to that. This town went through a trauma that is going to take a long time.
Yeah.
Karen Avenen has been our guest at the Radio Book Club this month. Her latest book is Rough Beauty, 40 Seasons of Mountain Living. And it's been great to have you at the Radio Book Club. We do encourage listeners to subscribe to our podcast, particularly after hours at the Radio Book Club, because Karen's going to join us there for some extended conversation.
Is that when we have the cocktails?
That's the happy hour version. Perfect. Here. So we'll have cocktails available. Don't worry, Karen. Karen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure.
And as we always do at the end of the Radio Book Club, we announce what we're reading in the next month. So in September, we've got another great local author. Arson, who have you selected?
Marcia Douglas, and it's a novel, The Marvelous Equations of the Dread. I'm really excited about this. It's magical realism to some extent, and it's about a resurrected Bob Marley, and each chapter is like a musical track. And I always think, you know, if anybody was to be resurrected, wouldn't it be great if Bob Marley was? So I'm really looking forward to having Marcia in the studio with us next month.
And Marcia is a professor at CU Boulder, so she is local, even though the topic itself isn't quite as local as what we've been reading in August. But you can hear Marcia Douglas talk about The Marvelous Equations of the Dread at the Radio Book Club on Thursday, September 27th at 9 a.m. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast of the Radio Book Club and After Hours at the Radio Book Club, an award-winning podcast. We've been talking about the award that we won this year. But in the meantime, I'd like to thank our author who's been featured this month, Karen Ovenen. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU, Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. As always, thanks for co-hosting.
Thank you.
You can always hear the Radio Book Club on the fourth Thursday of every month and find out more online at kgnu.org.